Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
This is Stuart Venner. I tell it as I see it, and I see it as it is.
It was interesting, but it was also stupid.
This is Stuart Venner. I want to welcome you to this week's show. We've got a great lineup of guests in store for you. We're speaking to Martin Adams. He's an expert on taxes, and he has a philosophy and a theory of how to live in a tax-free world. We're speaking to Dr. Carol Swain. She is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University, and we're discussing racism in America. We're speaking to Guy Smith. Guy is an expert on gun control and is going to talk about how we should protect our Second Amendment right to carry guns. We're speaking to Larry Farris. He is an expert on investments and the rules changing Regulation D, making it easier for companies to raise capital. And finally, we're speaking to T.W. Walker. He's going to tell us how to be an entrepreneur. Please stay tuned. I know you're going to love it. I've got a very interesting guest online. We're speaking to Martin Adams. Martin has written a book called Sharing the Earth, and it's a proposal for a tax-free and prosperous world. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
Well, my pleasure. Tell us, what is Sharing the Earth? What do you propose?
Well, Sharing the Earth is the result of really a lifelong quest. When I was a child, I looked at the world, and I realized that so many people had so little, when a few had quite a lot. And as a child, I asked myself, why is that? You see, this question kind of stayed with me all the way into my adulthood. And when I was an adult, I started exploring that deeper question: what causes wealth inequality?
Why do you think everyone should have the same thing?
I don't think so, not at all. So people sometimes mistake complete equality with fairness. That's not so. But we also live in a system, an economic system, that actually is unfair in a sense, because you see a lot of people work very, very hard and they're very good at what they do, but they don't make very much. But then you have some people, for example, those that inherit millions and millions of dollars, they don't really work very hard, but yet they have access to millions of dollars. So I asked myself, what really causes wealth inequality in our economy? And how can we incentivize a more just and prosperous world?
Well, if someone inherits money, should it be redistributed to the people that work hard that don't have any?
What I realized in my exploration is that there are two ways to make an income. The first way is through contributing valuable goods and services to society. And then you can also make an income by extracting an income from society. And in this case, in my book, Sharing the Earth, I focus on how people extract money from society. And a big way that people do it is actually through land speculation, real estate speculation, essentially. It's
okay.
A big way how people can make money without actually contributing something of value.
So you're actually proposing that people deal with land and real estate. What happens when the bubble happens?
The real estate bubble is a phenomenon that exists in our society because we have incentivized people to speculate with land. You see, if people could not profit or profiteer from land, we wouldn't be having these issues. There is actually, and I show this clearly in the book, several economists have actually predicted the real estate bubble 11 years before it happened, because they know that this real estate bubble happens every 18 years. So in 1997, two economists were on the record. They said in 1997 that we would have a huge economic recession because we have a bubble bursting in 2008.
We also had a lot of crooked loans being made.
Yeah, exactly.
So I still am trying to understand exactly what you mean. Maybe you can clarify it a little.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand them.
Yeah, so basically, when we buy a house, we don't just buy a house. We also buy the land that's underneath the house,
okay,
right? And of course we want this land to be ours. We bought it, you know. We have a right to it. And it should be that way. I mean, that's just right and proper. Now, what we need to understand is that when we buy and then sell that same house 4 years later, and let's say we sell it for more money, what actually happened is that it's not the house that became more valuable. It's the land underneath the house that became more valuable. Okay. And land only becomes more valuable when the surrounding environment becomes more prosperous. In other words, when you have more people moving to the area, when you have better infrastructure,
I follow that.
All of that stuff. Exactly. So the land value is actually a community product. And when other people make your land more valuable, you ought to repay the community that has made your land more valuable for that added benefit. So what I'm proposing in the book, Sharing the Earth, is that, look, there is actually no need for income and sales taxes if we tax people or charge people for their use of land. And economists have clearly demonstrated that that's actually the case. You don't have to tax income, sales, capital gains, and so forth, as long as you ask people to pay fees for their use of land.
So isn't that a little like communism?
Oh, no, not at all.
No,
communism
okay.
is actually, yeah, yeah, communism is the collectivization of land altogether.
So if I own land and the people around me, people move in around me and they're making the land more valuable, when I sell the land, they should get some of that money.
Yes. In fact, everyone should get some of that money in the form of payments to the local community, payments to the local government.
So it's wealth distribution. I bet you voted for Obama, didn't you?
Say again?
I bet you voted for Obama.
I actually didn't vote for Obama. Last election, I did not vote at all. In this case, what I would recommend is people look at this issue very clearly. And again, I have a lot of facts laid out in the book, Sharing the Earth. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so forth. And I have all the facts there. Economists, I have the backing of a lot of economists. They know the facts. And the problem is that these economists, they haven't yet gotten the public hearing.
Yeah, but let me ask you a question. I buy a piece of property. I buy a house. I've had to put the down payment down. I've had to make the mortgage payments. And if I didn't make the mortgage payment, they're going to take the house from me, or if I didn't pay my real estate taxes. And then when I sell this house, I should give that money, if I'm fortunate enough to sell it at a profit, to my neighbors because they moved in?
Well, Stuart, you mentioned a very good example. But the example that you mentioned happens in the context of an economy that has already been, misaligned. The economy that we currently exist in is standing on, let's say, the foundations of our economy are not solid. And our current mortgage situation, our current housing situation, is built upon a weak foundation. What we essentially have to do, and this is no easy task, this is what I'm saying in the book, is you have to actually redesign our economy from scratch. And it's a very difficult thing to do.
Now, what if I own a house in, like Gary, Indiana, or before it got real bad, and then it got worse? Should all these people that moved in give me money, reimburse me for what I've lost? That's like sharing the wealth. That's putting it back, isn't it?
People, when they own a house, they should keep their house. You know, it's certainly, you know, people that have bought a house, bought real estate, if they can, you know, make the mortgage payment and so forth, I'm not advocating people to give that up at all.
But what I'm saying is when you sell that house for a profit, what you're advocating is that you share this wealth with the people around you that made it better.
Well, what I'm saying really is that we should remove taxes, income taxes, sales taxes, capital gains taxes, and so forth.
Okay.
And then have homeowners instead, you know, people that own land, especially larger landowners,
right.
Have them pay a quarterly or monthly fee for the value for the land that they use. And that fee is a fraction of the value of their properties. And when we do that, our economy becomes a lot more efficient.
Because you're saying that people that moved around you helped the infrastructure and made your property more valuable.
Correct, yeah.
Now, what if the people come around you and make your property worse?
Well,
should they pay you?
You know, whether the value of the house that you own will decrease, you know, like we see in Detroit. People, you know, Detroit is becoming, is going downhill, and the values of people's homes in Detroit are decreasing.
Correct. Now should the people that moved around there and made it decrease in value by making the infrastructure worse and the crime worse, should they have to pay you that money for what you've lost?
Well, if the home decreases in value, you, as the homeowner, would have less of an obligation. So your monthly
okay,
fee
so if you got that obligation to take the loss, I think you should have the obligation to keep the profit. No?
Keep this obligation to keep the profit is an interesting one. You see, profit is should be redefined as contributing to society. When someone is an employee and they take home a paycheck, they should keep that money because they made an earnest contribution to society. However, when you're a homeowner and you buy a house, buy low, and you sell high, you actually didn't contribute to society unless you built a house. You know, that you can keep a profit for.
Well, Larry, I can't tell you, this has been, Martin, this has been very, very interesting. And Martin, can you tell everyone how to get hold of your book? Because I'd like to read more about it, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This topic, by the way, is controversial. It is not easy to understand right away, but I encourage people to visit my website at sharingtheearth.com.
Okay.
And you can see more.
Now, everybody, you go to sharingtheearth.com. And you can read Martin Adams' book. It is a little controversial, but it's been very interesting talking to him. Martin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Are you stuck with a timeshare? Did you attend the presentation and were seduced and enticed into buying that great vacation and investment? Now you're in the terrible position of trying to figure out a way to get out of that mess. You're not alone. For over 15 years, BuyYourTimeshare.com has been helping people like yourself get out of timeshare ownership. The fact is, there is no resale market. Unscrupulous telemarketers call you and say they have buyers waiting, and the next thing that happens is you give them hundreds of dollars for an ad, and you'll never hear from them again. Another fact is that an identical timeshare to yours is being offered on eBay for a dollar, and no one is buying it. If you want out of your timeshare, I urge you to go to buyyourtimeshare.com or call them at 877-94-HELP-ME. That number again is 877-94-HELP-ME. BuyYourTimeshare.com. That's BuyYourTimeshare.com. 877-94-HELP-ME. 877-94-HELP-ME.
Welcome back to the show. I've got a really great guest on the phone. We're speaking to Dr. Carol Swain. Dr. Swain is a professor at Vanderbilt University, and she is probably the expert today on racism and black-white relations. Carol, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Well, I am a professor of political science and of law at Vanderbilt University, and I'm also the host of a television show that I created last fall called Be the People. And mostly what I try to do is speak truth to power on the various issues of our day, and as an African-American or as a black person, a lot of times I'm talking about race and race relations.
And today, how do you think there's more racism today than there was 30, 40 years ago? What do you think?
I don't think there's more racism today, but I believe that race relations have suffered in a number of ways, and that we have a long way to go, that there are issues that need to be addressed. One of the things that stands in the way of addressing issues is the political correctness that's so rampant. I believe that whites have grievances, you know, blacks have grievances. People talk past one another, and we are perceiving different realities.
I totally agree with you there. I mean, today you have to be so careful of whose toes you're going to step on anywhere.
I don't agree that you have to be, but I believe that there are forces trying to impose straitjackets on us when it comes to conversations about sensitive issues, and I don't believe that's very constructive. I think if we want to advance race relations in this country, we have to begin talking with each other honestly, and we have to talk about those grievances. And a lot of white people are concerned about black crime, especially in the inner city, and that does not get adequately addressed.
Well, I think that starts in the family. I mean, that's where
it all
emanates.
You mean the criminal behavior?
The behavior, yes, criminal behavior. And
well, the criminal behavior, I think there are a number of different factors that causes that to be a problem. but it is an issue for our nation, yet it's not being discussed, and it's not being discussed in some cases because of political correctness and the fact that people don't want to be offensive, yet it's behavior that's real. It needs to change, and maybe it won't begin to change until blacks and whites begin to speak honestly to each other as well as within their own groups.
Well, you know, I personally don't see racism except when it's being brought to the forefront by people like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, and I think they're so ingenuous with their issues.
Whether we call it racism or rational fears, I think that there are behaviors that take place between blacks and whites, and that some of it is based on fear. And so, there's definitely some racism that takes place, and it's on all sides. It's not just black. It's not just white racism against blacks. I think that every group is capable of racism. I don't agree with those who argue that to be racist you have to have power, so that it is impossible for a black person to be racist because black people don't have power. Maybe you could say that 50 years ago or 60 years ago, but you can't say it when you have a black president and a black attorney general and blacks in positions of power throughout the country. So you cannot no longer say that blacks are not capable of racism.
I agree with you there, but I also think that our president and our attorney general are trying to fuel the fire of racism, especially with this thing that just happened
with Zimmerman. Well, I believe a number of people would say that, and they would say that the Department of Justice hasn't always been the most neutral, and that it looks at times as if Democratic strategists have decided to fan the flames of racism as a way to get votes, and that's very unfortunate because once you stir people up, it's not that easy to calm them back down.
That is very true. I mean, this thing that just happened in Florida with George Zimmerman, of course, everyone's been talking about that, but to me, I saw no racism there. I just didn't see it.
Well, I mean, I think the jury has already spoken on
yes.
that. The FBI investigated the case, and they said there was no evidence that George Zimmerman was a racist. And for political reasons, I would argue, the activists stepped in, the Department of Justice, and people that saw an opportunity.
What do you
know, maybe to gain votes or to galvanize people, they took advantage of a situation. And that is one where it's not clear at all that racism was a factor. Yet it fit a certain narrative, and it has been, people are equating it with Emmett Till, the young black teenager that was murdered in the 1950s for whistling at a white woman.
I saw
and we
no
know that there's no comparison whatsoever. With Trayvon Martin and Emmett Till. I mean, it's like night and day, but yet you have people like Oprah even saying that Trayvon Martin is another Emmett Till.
And that's just fueling the fire of racism, as far as I can see.
You know, maybe they believe that. And if they do, it's because they've not taken the time to look at the facts.
I totally agree. What do you feel, Dr. Swain, about the immigration problem we're having with the Hispanics? What do you think would be the right answer?
Well, first, I feel that our nation abandoned any notion of the rule of law a long time ago. Had they not abandoned that, we would see enforcement of the existing laws, and if existing laws were enforced, we'd not have this serious problem. And it is a serious problem. The government keeps talking about 11 million illegal immigrants when we know that there are far more than 11 million. That's a convenient number that they seized upon some years ago.
Right.
There's no telling how many people are undocumented in this country. And it's very difficult, I would say, it should be difficult for them to rally support for legalizing that many people and saying, you know, that we need the labor when there are 57 million Americans who are unemployed. And the black teenage unemployment rate is something like 41.6%, and these are people that are out there actually looking for jobs. And as long as we have 57 million Americans unemployed and you have 41.6% of black teenagers looking for jobs, not able to find jobs, and I would say that that's one of the reasons that you have so much crime is that you have idle young people. And some of those idle young people would probably rather be working. 41.6%, you know, that are looking for jobs are unemployed. And the immigration situation, if it leads to a widespread amnesty, it's not going to help that situation, nor will bringing in more low-skilled guest workers.
Well, I do remember, though, back a long time ago, I was originally from California, they had the Bracero program, which was a program where they brought in farm workers, and they had camps set up, and at the end of the season, they would go back to Mexico. And it was a good program, and it seemed to work rather well, and I think that kind of stopped when Cesar Chavez started the farm workers union.
But yes, I know about that program, and there are some immigration experts that would argue that eliminating that program actually worsened the problem.
That's what I was point I was making.
So that once people got into the country, instead of going back home, they just went deeper into the interior. And so what used to be a problem for the border states became a problem for Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina. And so now we don't have just a regional illegal immigration problem. We have one that's national in scope.
Exactly. That was the point I was trying to make, and I agree with you 100%. Dr. Swain, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
Are you stuck with a timeshare? Did you attend the presentation and were seduced and enticed into buying that great vacation and investment? Now you're in the terrible position of trying to figure out a way to get out of that mess. You're not alone. For over 15 years, BuyYourTimeshare.com has been helping people like yourself get out of timeshare ownership. The fact is, there is no resale market. Unscrupulous telemarketers call you and say they have buyers waiting, and the next thing that happens is you give them hundreds of dollars for an ad, and you'll never hear from them again. Another fact is that an identical timeshare to yours is being offered on eBay for a dollar, and no one is buying it. If you want out of your timeshare, I urge you to go to buyyourtimeshare.com or call them at 877-94-HELP-ME. That number again is 877-94-HELP-ME. BuyYourTimeshare.com. That's BuyYourTimeshare.com. 877-94-HELP-ME. 877-94-HELP-ME.
Welcome back to the show. I've got a great guest on the line. We're going to be speaking to Guy Smith. He's a leading independent gun control policy researcher. And we're going to learn a lot about protecting, I think, our Second Amendment. Guy, welcome to the show.
Hey, always a pleasure to be with you, sir.
Thank you. Tell us about what you're doing and what your field, your ideas are and your thoughts are on gun control.
Well, for the last 15 years, I've been an independent researcher on gun control policy. And by independent, I mean that I don't take money from anyone, not the pro-gun groups, not the anti-gun groups.
Okay.
And I spend an inordinate amount of time bouncing in and out of criminological research, sociological research. And over those 15 years, I've been compiling a book called Gun Facts, which anyone can get a free electronic copy of just by going to gunfacts.info. And through that, I have discovered just an amazing amount of hokum and bunkum and snake oil that has been on the political marketplace concerning gun control. And that has been my mission.
It's using two hands.
Two hands and a very good night-oriented scope with a beep dot.
Well, you live in California. I guess no one can carry a gun there.
Worse yet, I live in San Francisco where they keep trying to ban the darn thing.
Oh, my God.
California is one of the few remaining backwards-thinking states that has not recognized that concealed carry does not cause any harm and may actually create a lot of public good.
Well, I personally have a concealed weapons permit. I'm in Florida. And I feel, I don't carry it all the time, but sometimes I feel very comfortable when I need to.
Well, you know, I grew up in Florida, and I moved away the same year that they passed concealed carry. Mm-hmm. And I left there to go to Virginia. And 7 years later, I moved away from Virginia the same year that they passed concealed carry in Virginia. So all my friends here in California are offering to give me money to move away under the theory that history will repeat itself and we'll finally get concealed carry out here.
Well, you know, I remember back in the early, I think it was the early 70s, and at the time I had business interests in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was living in California myself at the time, and I would travel quite regularly to Atlanta, and I seem to remember that they passed a concealed weapons law. They gave, actually they let almost anyone who wasn't a convicted felon or someone convicted of a violent crime, they were allowed to carry a concealed weapon. And I remember that city went from the murder capital at the time in the country to probably one of the safest cities.
And that's something that the political left never likes to admit. There is a huge deterrence factor with private firearm ownership. Criminologists keep breaking into prison because they like to go in and mentally molest the prisoners there and ask them a lot of invasive questions like,
sure,
where did you acquire your gun? Who did you try to commit crimes against while you were out in the street and whatnot? And it has become very clear from that research, if a criminal ever is uncertain whether you are armed, they will leave you alone.
Well, that's what happened in Atlanta, and that's exactly the truth. And I can't tell you how much I agree with you, Guy, on this. The criminals are going to get the guns anyway, because they're breaking the law anyway.
That's true. I'm a little bit behind on my research. I'm always a little bit behind. But one of the things that we know is that there have been a couple of states that either for a long time or very recently have gone to what they call constitutional carry, which means as long as you have never been convicted of a felony, you can go ahead and carry a gun and you don't even need to bother getting a license first.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to be very interested in digging into that research and documenting what the change in violent crime rates are, because we know this for a fact. Criminals are going to carry concealed regardless of what the law says.
Sure, they're lawbreakers anyway, but they're going to all of a sudden follow one law?
Yeah, it's part of their job description.
Breaking the law is their business.
Exactly. And so I'm going to be very interested to see what the swings in violent crime are when the criminals suddenly become aware of the fact that they have zero guarantees about who may or may not be armed in public.
Well, I think that's totally true, and I think you're going to find the statistics are going to show that they're going to stay away from the people if they think they got guns.
The statistics have shown that over and over again. One of the things that I find interesting, over in the UK, you know, they have a virtual ban on firearms.
Yes.
They even prosecute people.
I don't think even the police carry guns there, I don't think.
They're carrying them more often now because one of the side effects of banning the guns is that the thugs have become pretty violent in all of their activities. But over in the UK, they have a much higher rate of burglary, and they have a much higher rate of hot home burglaries, which is where they will bust into your house knowing you are there and then tie you up, rob you, and then if they think you're an inconvenient witness, kill you. And they do that because they have absolutely no fear of retaliation from a homeowner. Here in the United States, hot home burglaries are statistically very rare because a burglar pretty much assumes that half the homes that they break into, there will be a gun there and the owner will retaliate.
Well, I think probably for a home, my personal feeling is the best home protection weapon is probably a shotgun.
You know, everybody who is in the firearm side of the business has a different opinion about it. I'm a little old school. I still like my .45 ACP, but could not convince my wife to try .45, so she's sticking with her .38 snub nose.
Yeah, that's what I have, a .38 special, because I just kind of like the feel of a revolver.
You know, a standard .38 caliber revolver is arguably the best all-around firearm for people who are unfamiliar with them. They are ultimately reliable. It's a good caliber, and every criminal recognizes the profile of a revolver.
That's right. That's for sure. Some of these guns don't even look like guns that are out there today.
Well, my wife, when she bought her Smith & Wesson revolver, she also bought a set of Ho grips in pink. And I had the distasteful duty of going down to the local dude-oriented gun shop to have them install the pink grips. And I maintain she got the pink grips because she didn't want me firing her gun at the gun range.
That's interesting. How do you feel about the legality of assault rifles? I mean, or machine guns, you know, automatic. Do you think those need to be out on the street, really?
You know, that's an interesting question. First, we have to come to grips with the fact that assault weapon is a completely made-up term. There are 19 different definitions of assault weapons on the books in various states, localities, and formerly at the federal level. So we can't even talk about assault weapons because the definition is constantly shifting and way too vague. Now, if we want to talk about assault rifles, which is a military classification of a specific firearm, then I don't find any problem with public ownership of those because, criminologically speaking, thugs don't want to carry those. The average AR-15 is longer than the upper torso of the average American male. And it's quite inconvenient to have the muzzle of a rifle sticking up through the top of your hoodie. It just really completely kills the concealability concept. And we know from the literature that criminals really prefer mid-range caliber revolvers and pistols because of their concealability. So these assault weapons in rifle format or assault rifles, public ownership of that is not a problem.
Well, you know, I do feel, though, I think it's kind of obvious that the administration, certainly the one we have today, wants to take away our guns.
Well, they are the ultimate statist, and you cannot be an ultimate statist until the population is disarmed.
Well, that's what I was getting at, but I think we have enough populace here in this country, especially being in the South where I am. There's enough guys riding around in their pickup trucks that are just not going to give up their shotguns and their rifles and their handguns.
Well, you know, I don't worry about national disarmament for that reason, but there are two other reasons which I find very interesting in terms of political mechanics. The first is that the states are already revolting against the federal government. Whether they're legal or not, they're passing laws that say, we know what the Second Amendment is, don't ever bother trying to come down here and telling us otherwise. And the sheriffs of those states are pretty much openly saying, you know, if you come down here and try to take guns, we are the local law enforcement that will keep federal agents from doing so. That, you know, is a very, very bold statement that they're
interesting.
Making. But the other part of it is that the federal government would have to unleash federal troops to do any type of disarmament.
Yeah, and that, I don't think that could ever happen.
And some surveys back in the 1990s indicated that members of the military would never do that to the American populace because they obey the Constitution, not the commander-in-chief, if there's ever a conflict between the two. So I have a few worries about that.
This has been a really interesting discussion. Guy, you've written a book, haven't you? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, the book Shooting the Bull came out not so long ago, and it is two things. It is first a primer on being able to identify political propaganda in the evening news, and you think you're being spun. This book will not only confirm that, but it will teach you how to identify that and recognize it regardless of what the political issue is. But I use the gun control industry as the case study throughout the book. So if you really want an end-to-end tour de force of every bit of hokum that the gun control movement has lobbed at the public, this is a great primer.
Shooting the Bull. And how can we get that book? Where is it available, Guy?
Shooting the book is available online just about everywhere. Go to Amazon, and it's definitely available both in print and Kindle format.
Well, everybody, you hear this, you go online to Amazon, Kindle, Barnes & Noble, I imagine, everywhere, and you get Shooting the Bull by Guy Smith. Guy, it's been great talking to you.
Are you stuck with a timeshare? Did you attend the presentation and were seduced and enticed into buying that great vacation and investment? Now you're in the terrible position of trying to figure out a way to get out of that mess. You're not alone. For over 15 years, BuyYourTimeshare.com has been helping people like yourself get out of timeshare ownership. The fact is, there is no resale market. Unscrupulous telemarketers call you and say they have buyers waiting, and the next thing that happens is you give them hundreds of dollars for an ad, and you'll never hear from them again. Another fact is that an identical timeshare to yours is being offered on eBay for a dollar, and no one is buying it. If you want out of your timeshare, I urge you to go to buyyourtimeshare.com or call them at 877-94-HELP-ME. That number again is 877-94-HELP-ME. Buyyourtimeshare.com. That's buyyourtimeshare.com. 877-94-HELP-ME. 877-94-HELP-ME.
Welcome to the show. I've got a very interesting man online. We're speaking to Larry Farris. Larry is an expert in SEC reforms, and we're going to talk a little bit about that and Regulation D. Larry, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. It's great.
Well, it is my pleasure to have you. I think that there's a lot of changes going on with the SEC. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're talking about?
Well, slowly but surely, and frankly, it's difficult to anticipate what I perceive as a positive impact of the change to the SEC. And to it's a great backstory. It's a wonderful opportunity to kind of explore the way the government makes itself in a sausage process. But essentially what's happened in the last few weeks is that an 80-year-old gag rule that prohibited a typical middle American business from raising money has been from private capital has been removed.
So they're taking away the blue sky laws, is that what you're saying?
No, it's not a blue sky law. No? This is a rule that has been in place since 1933 that essentially said if you want to go out and raise money, and you either have one of two options. You have to register an offering, mm-hmm. which is a very expensive and very heavy lifting kind of process that the average business can't get through. Or, you know, you literally become a public offering like Pepsi or something. And then you have the other option of doing a private offering, but you can only communicate a private offering to people whom you already know and people who you reasonably believe to be millionaires or extreme high annual incomers.
So they've taken away the qualified investor part of it?
Nope, just the knowledge, just the relationship. So what that means then is instead of having, before, if you didn't know 50 millionaires, you were hosed. You had no access to significant capital because you need to have a pretty decent volume of millionaire buddies to find the ones that are interested in doing what you're doing that month.
I see.
Today, it means that women, minorities, and people who are running a business on Main Street in Ohio can now they can do their own limited private offering. They can create all the documentation, put together a nice package, and deliver that package to anybody they want. They can still only take money. This is a beautiful place of protection. The consumer is still protected because you can still only raise money from a millionaire, but you don't have to know they're a millionaire before you talk to them, and you don't have to have a business relationship with them.
So would this work in the case of crowdfunding?
Crowdfunding is the next tier down. Crowdfunding would be if you're looking for smaller amounts of money from a broader tier, you put something on the internet. I don't do a lot of work in that area yet. I'm not clear that all the kinks have been worked out. But this is the next tier up. When you're looking for $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, $5 million, $50 million, you're looking for serious business capital to expand, grow a business, start a business, technological research, things like that. I mean, normally $200,000 doesn't get you very far unless you're doing pool cleaning or something like that, which, hey, I'm all in favor of the pool cleaners of the world. I love entrepreneurship. It's just that, you know, the area that we serve is the next tier up.
I'm trying to understand this a little bit. So if you're trying to raise some venture capital, and now are you able to advertise without having to register with the SEC as long as your investors are qualified investors?
That's correct. You can now advertise, and you can advertise to anybody. But you can only accept investments from qualified investors.
I understand. So they still have to fill out the form, and you still have to do your due diligence.
Correct.
Okay. But it gives you a chance to run an ad in the Wall Street Journal or anywhere you want.
As long as you specify
that they're qualified investors.
Exactly. I'm not even sure that you have to specify they're qualified investors in the ad. There's still some rules that are coming out from that. But you can only receive an investment from a qualified investor. And so there's a whole series of exemptions of securities regulations under Reg D and Section 504 to 506, if anybody wants to look it up. And this really blows the hole open, because if you think about for the last 80 years, Wall Street, investment banks, insurance companies, pension funds, and banks have really had kind of a death grip on the flow of capital in America. that they by this rule primarily, they've been able to control the trillions of dollars in investor capital.
They sure have.
U.S. And this rule is going to, whereby we won't see it huge, I mean, everything takes a little bit to catch on, but it's such a beautiful fundamental shift in the power base in America that over the next decade or so, we're going to see, I think, an enormous shift in the culture of America, in who's managing money, where's the money being placed, how is money being proffered, and when you change money from centralized control in New York to distributed control on Main Street, That is a huge shift to America. And I, you know, if you'd follow me on Facebook a year ago when they passed this law, like Facebook, they said, hey, this is the beginning of the end of the recession. This is the beginning of the recovery. Now, of course, it took the federal government over a year to write the rules to reduce regulation. I thought that was so appropriate.
Yeah.
But it really is the beginning of
it certainly
of
does sound like a step in the right direction, because this way the small guy can compete with Goldman Sachs.
Absolutely, and the other side is Goldman Sachs can't really compete with a small guy.
No, they
if you
really
think
can't.
About it creates a beautiful balancing act here, where the small guy can be more lean, can have a more targeted investment, and most of the things I've seen in the private equity world have had returns that are well above that the typical investors would ever have access to.
I am sure of that. Larry, can you tell us about your background and what you do?
Sure. You know, I have kind of a funny odd background. I had an opportunity to do some foreign service work in Brazil in the mid-'80s, and I spent about a year and a half in the Amazon. And I happened to learn Portuguese. When I came back to the U.S., I was majoring in finance, and I got recruited by the Bank of Ecuador to go back down. My first job was the Bank of Ecuador. And the reason I mentioned Portuguese is because they wanted someone who spoke Portuguese, English, had American passport, had finance background to go down and direct international exchange and be involved in that international exchange process in Ecuador.
Interesting.
So that was my first job was working in a bank doing very complex international exchange transactions. And I loved it. I liked the complexities. I liked the nuances. Ecuador had a currency that was difficult to get in exchange for hard currency, and there was a lot of oil expansion going on at the time period of their OPEC relationships. So I spent most of my time negotiating. I was 24 years old, and I was negotiating large deals, trying to get bananas and currency packages and anything else, and shrimp and any other exports we could, into hard currency that we could then exchange into hard assets that would be effective for oil and gas exploration. And had a great time, spent less than a year doing it, and then came back to the States, went to work for a broker-dealer for a while. And then I became really disgusted in what Wall Street was all about. It didn't take me very long to see, from my perspective, is it was kind of a scam that, you know, became pretty obvious that all the deals were cut off Wall Street and then brought to Wall Street for the, quote, dumb money. And, I just became where I just couldn't tolerate the what I perceived as just the,
well,
the
are you,
culture.
Are you now helping people raise venture capital?
Yeah, well, in 93, I started my own company, and we started solving the old idea then was is to create a structure so that you could solve problems and to bring highly secured debt to a transaction that also had some need for sophistication. And so we did everything from you know real estate restoration projects to methamphetamine cleanups to oil spill cleanups. You know, it took a level of sophistication and some capital to get the projects done, and we have managed money for investors for, you know, a couple of decades.
You must have known a lot of millionaires.
Well, I knew a few, and I was blessed to have some experience there. And in the meantime, I was running a good portion of Republican Party activities in the state, and involved in the congressional district, and I was a presidential elector, and so I got a chance to meet some people through that process. And then about 5 years ago, my company got hired to consult and develop a renewable energy investment fund, and we've been almost exclusively focused on renewable energy for about the last 5 years, and raised success of about $20 million under the Reg D rules, under these exact same rules, but you had to have a prior relationship with people.
Right.
And so that's, you know, it's been 20 years of investing in a highly secured, high return kind of environment. It's been a great ride, solved a lot of problems, felt great about the world. And the last 5 years, it's been very aggressively engaged in, you know, thousands probably of solar projects and renewable energy projects. And, if you spend 20 years in the trenches, you get
Larry,
pretty good.
Can you tell the folks how to, if they need your services or want to learn more, how they can reach you?
Sure. 2100, the number is 2100west.com is kind of a catch-all for us. The idea is we're 2,100 miles west of Wall Street.
All right, everybody. We've been speaking to Larry Farris, a very interesting guy. And if you're looking for venture capital and you need it, and now with the changes in Reg D, I think that he's the guy that can help direct you in the right place. Go to 2100west.com. Larry, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Are you stuck with a timeshare? Did you attend the presentation and were seduced and enticed into buying that great vacation and investment? Now you're in the terrible position of trying to figure out a way to get out of that mess. You're not alone. For over 15 years, BuyYourTimeshare.com has been helping people like yourself get out of timeshare ownership. The fact is, there is no resale market. Unscrupulous telemarketers call you and say they have buyers waiting, and the next thing that happens is you give them hundreds of dollars for an ad, and you'll never hear from them again. Another fact is that an identical timeshare to yours is being offered on eBay for a dollar, and no one is buying it. If you want out of your timeshare, I urge you to go to buyyourtimeshare.com or call them at 877-94-HELP-ME. That number again is 877-94-HELP-ME. Buyyourtimeshare.com. That's buyyourtimeshare.com. 877-94-HELP-ME. 877-94-HELP-ME.
Are you in the terrible position of owing more than your real estate is worth? It just doesn't make sense to throw more good money after bad. At some point, it does make good sense to cut your losses. Don't count on failed government programs that in the end make your problem even worse. We are years away from a housing recovery. Disposing of it incorrectly could create disastrous tax consequences and ruin your credit. You could even pay income tax on the lender's loss. I'm Stuart Venner, president of the Wilshire Holding Group. With over 18 years' experience, we have the proven solution to your problem, a way to dispose of that upside-down property without incurring tax liability and minimize any negative credit. Don't walk away from the property. Call us first. Go to realtycrisis.com or call 877-94-HELP-ME. That's realtycrisis.com, realtycrisis.com, 877-94-HELP-ME. Don't lie awake nights worrying. We're here to help you. Realtycrisis.com, 877-94-HELP-ME. Realtycrisis.com, 877-94-HELP-ME.
Folks, welcome back to the show. I've got a very interesting guest on the phone. We're speaking to T.W. Walker. T.W. is an entrepreneur. And he's the author and the creator of the Entrepreneur Breakthrough Blueprint. T.W., welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Tell us, what is this blueprint?
This blueprint is basically about 20 years of my work compiled into a system and all the lessons I've learned from just creating different businesses along the way. And I've decided to take everything public and put it into a system to help other entrepreneurs out.
I think that's wonderful. And you've written a book, which I understand has been endorsed by the Napoleon Hill Foundation.
I have.
That's quite good.
Superhero Success.
It's a law of success? What is a law of success?
It's actually called Superhero Success.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the law of success was actually written by Napoleon Hill, and ironically, my book, it was kind of probably best described as Who Moved My Cheese meets Calvin and Hobbes. It's a very clever story that I wrote, written in three different perspectives, about a father who is trying to teach his young son the principles of success. And a little story unfolds there, but and it's written with the adult audience in mind for achievers and whatnot, but just a very fun story utilizing the laws of success by Napoleon Hill to just get people to think and a little differently about how they go about their lives and their businesses to achieve more success faster.
Do you have to be do you have to have a ton of money to be an entrepreneur?
Well, no. I've personally started businesses with 10 minutes of my time, so however much the time is worth, but I mean if you're going to start an oil investment company or something, yeah, I'm
well,
sure there's going to have to be some money involved.
But there are a lot of opportunities for people out there that really don't have a lot of capital that can really, with the right idea, can make it work.
Well, absolutely, and it really all goes back to a philosophy that I have called capability. All going back to the superhero success philosophy, I mean...
Well, what is superhero success exactly?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Well, how would you? What is superhero success and capability?
Sure. Well, that's what I was just getting ready to say.
Okay.
As it pertains to becoming an entrepreneur, you've got to have your cape in place, because once you have the cape and your capability, that's when the superpowers are unleashed, and it's character, attitude, perseverance, and enthusiasm. And I established this early on in my life because I was in a severe car accident at 3 years old, not expected to live another day, shattered nearly every bone in the left side of my body, and spent 9 months in a body cast.
Wow.
And I had no other choice but to learn how to persevere and be enthusiastic, because they didn't expect me to live. And I learned all these things, not in that particular order, over the years, and it kind of set the foundation, if you will, to everything I've ever done. Every little business from when I was a kid to every business I've started as an adult, and all the successes and failures.
Well, I know that you speak a lot about fear, TW, and fear is something that everyone has to deal with, but that's, I think, something that stops a lot of people, doesn't it?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear all the questions.
I think fear is probably one of the biggest stumbling blocks for a lot of people.
Absolutely it is, absolutely.
And how do you deal with that? What's, in a short sentence, what's the best way to deal with something like that?
Put your cape on. Character, okay. Attitude, perseverance, and enthusiasm. That will knock fear out, punch it right in the face every single time.
I think so. I mean, I never have been afraid of that, but I know a lot of people are. So many salesmen, they go out there, they're afraid of that plate glass window.
Yes, and it's also because they don't have the right type of goals in place.
So you do believe in goal setting.
People set goals all the time, but they don't really set the right type of goals that are achievable so they can have momentum of successes.
Well, I think that's so true. I mean, realistic goals are what you have to set. It's fine to say, I want to be the king, but that's certainly not realistic. But you have to set goals that people can achieve.
Right. I've actually got a philosophy on that, too, and everybody seems to love it, because it's just, I do everything in metaphors. Because metaphors, people remember, but all going around the whole superhero theme, I mean, you got super goals. Specific, urgent, planned, exciting, and relevant. You back that up with hero, which is habits, excellence, responsibility, and you'll have the outcomes you want every single time.
Very interesting. Now, I know you have a home study course. That's the Entrepreneur Breakthrough Blueprint, right?
That is correct.
How can people learn more about that and maybe enroll in this and get this?
They can go to entrepreneurbreakthrough.com, at which point they will be able to learn all about it.
Okay, that sounds very good. Now, for all of you out there, it's entrepreneurbreakthrough.com, and in case you don't know how to spell, I'll spell it for you. It's E-N-T-R-E-P-R-E-N-E-U-R, breakthrough.com, B-R-E-A-K-T-H-R-O-U-G-H. TW, you've been very, very interesting, and I think we've all learned a lot from you. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show.
I believe it myself.
Aren't you ashamed?